They say Atlantis, where dreams are made. I guess that makes sense, because I was dreaming when I met her. Celeste was all confidence, gym tight skin, and perfume that stuck in your mind like a song. She was twice my age and somehow made me feel older, sharper. Like I had a role in something bigger than myself. But roles come with scripts. And hers, it was already written. I thought I was helping her escape a broken marriage. Truth is, I was just the escape. And when the lights came on, I wasn't the hero. I was the weapon. This is the story of how I got involved with a married woman, and how I nearly lost myself trying to be her salvation. If you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. The gym, the smile, the lie. The first time I saw her, she was standing in front of the mirror by the leg press, tying her hair into a high ponytail. Neon green leggings. White tank top. AirPods in. But her eyes were scanning the room like she wasn't really there. Like her body showed up, but her mind was in some server room of shadowed secrets, somewhere way off the grid. I was 19. New to Atlanta. New to everything, honestly. Just moved into a shared apartment off North Druid Hills. Started lifting because my roommate said it'd help with anxiety. But that gym became a portal. Because that's where I met Celeste Morgan. She smiled at me like she knew something. A slow, patient smile. One that didn't rush. Like the kind of smile a con artist might give just before sliding a contract across the table. At first, it was innocent. Spotting each other. Light conversation. I'd catch her between sets, and she'd ask these strange, introspective questions. Do you ever feel like people mistake silence for peace? If your body had a voice, what would it say today? Stuff I didn't expect from a woman who looked like she walked out of a real estate billboard. She made me feel seen. Not in a corny way. In a way that felt like she could scan all my layers in one glance. My awkward pauses, my nervous energy, the way I kept one earbud in like I didn't trust the world enough to be fully present. And I liked that. I liked that too much. The age thing. Yeah, I knew. I'm not stupid. I knew she was older. A lot older. I guessed mid-30s at first. Later, I'd learned she was 38. But when she talked, it didn't feel like we were from different timelines. She didn't talk down. She leaned in. She made me feel like I had influence, like I had value, like my mind mattered. And that's what manipulation often looks like. Not dominance, but curated flattery. Not control, but careful permission. So I asked her. I remember it clearly. We were by the stair climbers. She had her towel draped across the side rail and her hands on her hips, catching her breath. I asked, "So, are you married or something?" She didn't flinch, just tilted her head and smiled. "Technically, yes. But it's over. Just messy right now. Lawyers, paperwork, kids. You know how it goes." No, I didn't know how it goes. I was 19. My biggest conflict was whether to quit my part-time job at Best Buy. But I nodded like I did. She said they were still living together for the kids. Two boys, 17 and 15. She said her husband had checked out years ago, and that her marriage was more of a tax filing situation than a love story. She used that exact phrase. And I bought it. Because when someone like Celeste looks at you like you're the first person to really get her, you don't question it. Your mind races with fantasy, not red flags. We started seeing each other. Low-key at first. Texts. Late-night phone calls. She never wanted to meet at her place. Always some side cafe, a dim sushi bar in Midtown, or her car parked just off Peachtree. Her SUV smelled like expensive vanilla, leather, and a hint of rose. I was floating in it. My body felt 25 when I was with her. My mind was rewiring itself in real time. I didn't push to meet her kids. Didn't ask to go over. I figured it was complicated, and that respecting her boundaries made me mature. Turns out I wasn't respecting her privacy. I was protecting her lie. She had this way of mixing truth with illusion. She'd say things like, "You're the only thing that feels real to me right now. I used to feel dead inside until you started texting me at midnight. Don't become the man who walks away just because it's not easy." I was too young to realize I was being emotionally engineered. Influence in art. Persuasion in psychology. Celeste wasn't just surviving her marriage. She was crafting a narrative, and I was the tool. She started calling me her escape, and I wore that title like a medal. I thought I was helping her rediscover her womanhood. What I didn't know is that I was being used to redesign her ego. She was still married. Fully. No divorce papers. No legal process. No separation. The only thing she had separated from was accountability. It all cracked when her son found the messages. But that's a story for later. For now, I just want you to remember this. The most dangerous manipulation doesn't come from strangers in the dark. It comes from the person who makes you feel like your reflection finally has value. And I was in deep. Gym deep. Soul deep. Lie deep. Unspoken boundaries, unseen chains. It's strange how quickly something can feel normal, how what starts as a boundary becomes a routine, and then a cage you willingly decorate. Celeste never called me before 10 p.m. Never on weekends. Never during the day unless it was about gym stuff. And I accepted that. Told myself it was respectful. That she had to keep things quiet because of the kids. Looking back, I realize I was on a schedule of deception, carefully designed to keep her story believable. I wasn't her lover. I was her emotional side hustle, tucked into the back pocket of a life she swore was over, but never really was. The SUV was our world. She had a black Range Rover with tinted windows and seats that smelled like sugar and sin. We'd park behind a yoga studio in Buckhead or behind this Korean barbecue joint in Doraville. Anywhere dark, tucked away off-grid. It felt romantic at first. Like we were in on some celestial secret the world couldn't handle. But over time, I started noticing things, small psychological cracks. Her wedding ring was still in the center console. She never changed the screensaver on her car's display. It showed a photo of her, her husband, and the kids at Disney. And when I asked about it once, she replied, "It's just for appearances. Don't read into it. Everything in my life is just optics right now." And that's when it hit me. I wasn't part of a new beginning. I was part of an illusion she was curating to survive the old one. There was no talk of a real future. She never asked about my life outside of her. Never wanted to meet my friends. Never talked about taking a trip, moving forward, showing up for anything. But she had this way of anchoring me with phrases that sounded like ethereal poetry, like she was quoting some psychology of crime playbook mixed with NLP techniques. Some connections are too deep for daylight. "You're my favorite part of the day, the secret that keeps me sane. If you knew what I've been through, you'd see why I need this." Need. Not want. Need. It was like I'd been pulled into a sacred contract without knowing I'd signed it. A contract she had authored. And beneath every line was a clause of guilt. I started to shift. Slowly. Subtly. My mind was racing at night, trying to decode texts, dissect tones, predict when I'd hear from her next. I couldn't focus at work. I ghosted my friends. I stopped visiting my mom on Sundays. I became obsessed with the rules of the game I didn't even understand. I thought it was love, but it was emotional manipulation dressed in intimacy. One night she asked me, "Do you think you'd still want me if I wasn't broken?" And I swear to God, I didn't know how to answer. Because I didn't. I didn't know the real her. I only knew the version that showed up with wet hair and yoga pants in the dim glow of a car interior. I knew the woman who whispered about her dead marriage and kissed me like I was oxygen. But her real life? The one with two teenagers, a mortgage, and a husband who still shared her bed some nights? That life was invisible. She once cried in my arms, full on sobbing. Said her son had yelled at her. Said he called her a monster. Said he told her she was ruining their family. I asked if he knew about me. She nodded, wiped her eyes, then whispered. He saw the messages. He told his father. My stomach dropped. It was like hearing the end of a story I didn't know I was part of. The shadows of justice were closing in, and I wasn't the hero. I was the violation. I asked her if she wanted to stop. To pause. To fix things at home. She looked at me like I'd just stabbed her in the heart. "Don't you dare abandon me now. Not after everything we've been through. You don't get to walk away just because it's inconvenient." And just like that, I was caught. Bound not by affection, but by guilt. That's when I started to wake up. I began noticing the language she used. Subtle shifts. Behavioral psychology wrapped in romance. "You're the only one who listens. I gave you access to parts of me no one sees. I chose you when I could have just kept suffering in silence." These weren't compliments. They were psychological hooks. Persuasion methods built to enforce obligation. I told her once, "I'm scared I'm just another escape for you." She smiled, touched my face, and said, "You're not an escape. You're the reason I still believe in people. and in that moment I knew she would never take responsibility, not for any of this, because I wasn't a partner. I was a character in a script she'd been performing long before I entered the gym. I was the illusion she needed to feel alive. And my silence, that was the price of admission. Whispers in the SUV. There's something surreal about sitting in the passenger seat of a luxury SUV in the middle of the night while a married woman whispers affirmations into your ear like confessions to God. The Range Rover had become our sanctuary, our confessional booth, our war room. Leather seats, cracked iPhone charger, bottle of Fiji in the cup holder. And Celeste, always Celeste, leaning in with perfume-drenched words that left my mind racing hours after she dropped me off. It wasn't sex, not yet. Not entirely. But it was worse than that. It was emotional trespassing, slow, surgical. A form of psychological manipulation, so precise it felt holy. She'd run her fingers over my hand, eyes focused ahead like she couldn't bear to look me in the face. "You don't know what you're doing to me," she'd murmur. "You make me feel young, safe, dangerous." And I'd sit there, half lost in the dopamine flood, half suffocating under the weight of a situation I barely understood. There was something about the way the cabin light hit her cheekbones. Something about how the shadows from passing headlights danced across her face like the ghosts of a truth she would never say out loud. She wasn't just manipulating a teenager. She was rewriting her narrative, one whispered promise at a time. This one night, the line finally broke. We were parked off Cheshire Bridge Road, behind a boutique hotel that had shut down after COVID. The kind of place that felt like it had secrets buried in its drywall. She turned to me, eyes glossy, voice low. "I need to feel something. Please don't think, just touch me." The words hit like a shot of adrenaline and ice. Because for weeks, she'd been telling me we needed to keep things spiritual, not physical. That what we had was about mind, not body. But now, she wanted the body too. And in that moment, I wasn't thinking about ethical standards, emotional awareness, or the psychology of control. I was thinking about her breath on my neck, and her wedding ring flashing on the dashboard. I kissed her. She kissed back. It wasn't lust. It wasn't even romance. It was codependence wrapped in fantasy, and we were both drunk on it. After, she pulled away. Not far. Just enough. "Don't tell anyone," she whispered. "This is ours. This doesn't leave the car." And I agreed, of course. Because what else could I do? I was 19. She was 38. And that SUV was now the epicenter of a secret powerful enough to crack families. I didn't know it then, but that kiss wasn't the climax. It was the trigger. The start of a spiral I couldn't stop if I tried. She began texting me more. Possessive. Obsessive. "Where are you? Why haven't you answered? If I'm risking everything for you, the least you can do is show up." Her tone shifted. Less tender, more tactical. Like a con artist realizing their mark, had started asking questions. And then came the night I saw her husband. I was walking to my car after work, Best Buy, 9:45 p.m. Blue shirt, name tag still on. And there he was, leaning against a silver Lexus, arms crossed, watching me like a hawk clocking prey. Tall, clean-shaven, business casual, no emotion on his face. He didn't speak, didn't threaten me, just handed me a manila envelope. Inside, printouts of texts. Screenshots. My name. My face. "Stay away from my wife," was scribbled on a sticky note. That was all. No screaming. No fists. Just evidence. Cold, calculated evidence. That's when it all clicked. I hadn't just trespassed. I'd been baited. Celeste knew her son was suspicious. She knew her husband still had access to her phone. And she let it happen. Because now, she could say it wasn't her fault. She could blame me. She called me 2 hours later. Screaming. Crying. Hysterical. "You ruined everything. I told you I was trying to protect you. You're just a kid, you don't understand adult pain. Now my kids hate me. My husband wants a divorce. You pushed this. You did this." And I sat there, phone to my ear, heart pounding, staring into the dark corners of my room. I didn't speak. Because what could I say? I was a weapon she forged, and then blamed when it exploded. That night, I slept in my car. Parked in the gym lot where I first met her. I stared at the entrance for hours, wondering how I ever thought it was safe. And somewhere in the silence, I realized the truth. I was never in love. I was in a carefully engineered scenario, a victim of ethical collapse, a character in her personal crisis novel, a nameless variable in her emotional mitigation technique. and I wanted out. The son who knew. They say guilt is heavy. But that's a lie. Guilt isn't heavy. It's slippery. It moves. It slithers. It settles in your joints and pulses through your blood when you least expect it. Guilt isn't a weight, it's a vibration. A frequency. Something that turns your stomach every time your phone lights up with their name. And that's exactly how I felt the night her son called me. It started with a text. I know who you are. I know what you've done. No name. No greeting. Just shadowed truth delivered through pixels. My hands were shaking. I was in my room, door locked, laptop open but forgotten. My playlist was still running in the background. Some chill ambient mix I couldn't even hear anymore. The words on my screen blurred. I messaged back. Who is this? 3 dots. Then nothing for 10 minutes. 10 whole minutes of mind racing, heart thumping, panic creeping like black mold under my ribs. Then, I'm her son. I'm 17. I saw the messages. I saw the pics. I saw you. And just like that, the lie collapsed. No more pretending she was almost divorced. No more justifying our connection as spiritual or pure. I had become the villain in a story I didn't write. He called. I answered. His voice was calm, too calm. That kind of cold stillness you only hear from people who've been broken too many times. You think you're some savior? You think you gave her something my dad couldn't? You destroyed everything. You think she's the victim? You don't know her. You don't know what she's like when no one's watching. I tried to speak, but my throat was a locked door. He kept going. Do you know what it's like to watch your mom flirt with a kid who looks like your little brother's friend? To watch your dad lose sleep? To hear your mom moaning through the wall while your family rots? I wanted to scream. To tell him I didn't know. That I was manipulated too. That I had no idea I'd been living in a psychological game of persuasion techniques and emotional power dynamics. But I didn't. I just listened. Because he deserved to speak. Because I had no moral high ground. Because I wasn't innocent. Not anymore. He ended the call with one sentence I'll never forget. You're not the first. You won't be the last. But you might be the one that breaks her for good. Celeste called me minutes later. This time, there was no crying. No hysteria. Just surgical calm. That cold, high-functioning rage that only shows up when someone knows their mask has cracked and they're scrambling to put the pieces back together. Did he call you? What did you say? Are you proud of yourself now? I told her I didn't defend myself. I told her I didn't speak badly of her. She didn't believe me. You just proved them all right. You're a child. I thought you were different. I thought you were a man. That was the moment it all clicked. This was never about love. It was about control. She didn't want a partner. She wanted a loyal, pliable accomplice. I didn't go to the gym the next day. Or the day after. Or the week after that. I couldn't. Every bench press rack looked like a lie. Every scent of vanilla and leather made my stomach twist. I started researching terms I'd never used before. Grooming dynamics. Emotional gaslighting. Power imbalance relationships. Social manipulation in romantic settings. Cognitive psychology of codependence. Ethical standards in age gap affairs. I felt like I had been in a lab experiment without knowing. I was 19. She was 38. But in every way that mattered, she was the master. I was the canvas. A curated tale of influence, control, and collapse. Her husband filed for divorce 3 days later. Her kids stopped speaking to her. She deleted Instagram. Sold the SUV. Vanished from the gym. And yet, I couldn't stop thinking about her. Her scent. Her voice. Her whispers in the SUV. Manipulation is addictive. Even when you know it's poison. The blame game. Blame is the most powerful drug I've ever felt. Worse than lust. Stronger than guilt. More addictive than any validation Celeste ever whispered into my ear. Because when you're young, when you're still figuring out who you are, and someone twice your age makes you the reason their world burned down, you start to believe it. That's what she did. She turned pain into performance. Regret into revenge. And me, just a stupid 19-year-old with a gym bag and headphones, into the architect of her ruin. After the fallout, she called once a day. Then twice. Then 6. Texts. Voice notes. Voicemails. Some cold and surgical, like she was building a legal case in her head. Others drunk, wounded, pleading, explosive. You destroyed me. You're the reason I can't look my kids in the eye. I gave you everything and you fed me to the wolves. I protected you. You were supposed to protect me. Every sentence was a blade. And I didn't dodge. I let her cut me open, because somewhere deep inside I believed her. I stopped going out, stopped answering calls from friends, stopped eating right. I started recording voice memos in my phone just to process what I couldn't say out loud. And everyone started with, was I the monster or just the fool? I ran through every scenario, every psychological principle I could find. Cognitive dissonance, power imbalance, social manipulation, behavioral triangulation, group behavior breakdowns, manipulative personality profiles. But no theory could scrub the sound of her voice from my skull. Then came the email. Subject line, documentation for legal purposes. It wasn't from her. It was from her husband's lawyer. Inside were PDFs, screenshots, chat logs, a drafted statement accusing me of contributing to the emotional destabilization of a minor household. He was building a case. Not to sue me. To ruin her. And I was Exhibit A. She begged me to deny everything. Just tell them it wasn't real. That I made it up. That I had a breakdown. Help me fix this, please. I'm losing everything. Her voice cracked. I could hear the chaos around her. Kids yelling, a dog barking, cabinet doors slamming. It was the first time she sounded human. But even then, even broken, she found a way to twist the knife. If you loved me, truly loved me, you'd save me. And that's when I realized. This wasn't about love. This was about influence mastery. The art of persuasion pushed to its darkest edge. She was using every tactic in the book. Guilt, shame, seduction, isolation. She didn't want the truth. She wanted control. And I had none left to give. I sent a single reply to her email. You told me lies. I believe them. Now we both have to live with the truth. I won't cover for you. I won't lie for you. I won't be your collateral. She never responded, but that didn't stop the spiral. For weeks, I stayed in that mental cage, watching her Instagram go dark, watching friends post cryptic status updates clearly aimed at me. Some men really out here destroying families and walking around like heroes. I wasn't a hero, but I wasn't a criminal either. I started therapy, quietly. Met a counselor who specialized in coercive relationship recovery. She told me, what you experienced wasn't love. It was emotional engineering. What happened wasn't your fault, but it's now your responsibility to process it. She introduced me to concepts like true body intelligence, emotional awareness, power and control mapping, subtle manipulation in asymmetric relationships. For the first time, I had language for what I had lived through. And in the language, I found power. My final goodbye. It was raining the night I recorded my last message to her. Not a storm. Not cinematic thunder or flashing lightning. Just that steady Atlanta drizzle. Soft enough to sound like static, but heavy enough to keep the world quiet. Like the city was holding its breath. I parked in the same spot behind the gym where it all began. Phone in hand. Voice memo open. My heart steady for the first time in weeks. I hit record. Celeste, you probably won't listen to this. And if you do, I doubt it'll matter. I want to believe you meant some of the things you said. That those nights in your SUV, the whispered promises, the hand on my chest, I want to believe they weren't all calculated. But even if they weren't, the way you blamed me, the way you weaponized your own damage and buried me beneath it, that wasn't love. That was war. And I never signed up for that. You called me mature, then called me a child. You said I saved you, then said I destroyed you. You made me a fantasy, then made me a villain. You didn't want love. You wanted control disguised as connection. And I gave it to you. Willingly. That was my mistake. I thought being chosen by a woman like you meant I was strong. Turns out it meant I was vulnerable. But no more. I stopped recording and saved it. Didn't send it. Just kept it. Because some goodbyes don't need to be heard to be real. Some goodbyes are for you, not them. I never saw her again. Last I heard, she moved out of Buckhead. Sold the house. Her kids live with their dad now. She doesn't go to the gym anymore. Doesn't post online. She disappeared into the very silence she once told me she feared. Maybe she's healing. Maybe she's still manipulating the next person who thinks her eyes mean salvation. I don't know. But I'm not angry anymore. I learned something in the aftermath. That real leadership isn't about guiding others. It's about reclaiming yourself. That human dynamics can be dangerous when powered by dark psychology and hidden motives. That influence without ethics is just warfare with prettier weapons. Now I'm rebuilding, reading, working, sleeping, speaking out loud without guilt in my throat. I've started training again, but not at the old gym. This time, I lift for clarity, not for validation. This time, I know my body, true body intelligence. This time, I know my mind. And when I think of her, when I remember the SUV, the perfume, the whispered lies, I don't see a goddess or a monster. I see a woman, broken, brilliant, dangerous. And I see myself, no longer her puppet, no longer her penance. Just a young man who survived the specter of manipulation and walked out stronger.